Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Inside Politics. I'm John King in Washington. Thank you for sharing a very, very busy news day with us. 6,000 plus dead, 6,000 plus. Grief running over Turkey and Syria. Hope, too, running out as rescue crews continue to look for thousands still lost in the rubble of a monster earthquake. Plus, tonight, the president tells the country what he's done and where he wants to go. Advisors promise a classic Joe Biden speech, but his State of the Union collides with big global challenges and the complications of a newly divided Washington. Plus, a secret briefing. Congress gets access to intelligence about that Chinese balloon. And some brand new CNN reporting raises questions about why the Pentagon was so slow to shoot down that suspected spy in the sky. But up first for us, a dramatic, harrowing race to find survivors. It's barely more than 24 hours after a massive earthquake hit Turkey and Syria. Already, again, more than 6,000 are dead. And the aftershocks still creating treacherous conditions for rescuers trying to reach victims trapped in the rubble. More than 5,000 buildings have collapsed, falling tragically faster than many people could escape. In the devastation, there are, though, moments of hope, like this one. A young girl rescued after 24 hours, buried beneath concrete and bricks in Istanbul. And crews pulling a teenage boy from the rubble, lowering him to safety. Turkey's president has now declared a three-month state of emergency in the hardest-hit areas, and President Biden has pledged to provide assistance. That, part of a massive international response, a rescue effort now underway. Our CNN's Becky Anderson is live for us in Gaziantep, Turkey. Becky, tell us what you're seeing.
Yeah, well, it is bitterly cold here, John, but that is not dampening the efforts that are going on behind me here. This building was a 10-story building at 4:15 a.m. on Monday morning local time when that massive earthquake hit, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake, which shook this entire region. 23 million people, according to the WHO, have been affected by this quake. Not least those here in Gaziantep, in the west of the city, in a place called İbrahimali, where this road is based. And you can see, if you just pan, Charbel, to the building beside me, that is what this looked like some 36 hours or so ago. And that building, by the way, beside us, is unsafe. It's beginning to tilt to the left, and there are cracks on the first, second, and third floor. So we're not going to hang around here too long, but I do want to get you a sense of what's going on behind me. These members of the search and rescue units who are here on site have been working now around the clock, trying to ensure that they get to everybody unaccounted for. There are more than 15, as we understand it, still unaccounted for underneath the rubble here. And we've been here for about 4 hours, John. And what we've been witnessing is the sort of process through which these teams go, which is ensuring there is coordination, ensuring that they call for silence every so often, and turn the generators and the heavy machinery off when they believe they have heard a sign of life below the rubble. And that's happened four, five, or six times since we've been here, as I say, just in the last 4 or 5 hours. They've been using thermal and sound machinery to get down below the rubble. There are voids, we are told, difficult to get to, but there are voids. And amazingly, John, there are people who are actually using their mobile phones to communicate with the rescuers to say that they are still alive and they have seen that. And I'm sorry to say that as we speak, I'm just going to let Charbel give you this shot because they are clearly bringing somebody up. I can't tell whether that person is alive or dead. I understand that they're asking us to turn the camera away, and that is understandable. So I'm just going to move this way. I'm sorry, guys. I'll move this way. Absolutely. I'll move this way. Just to give you a sense. Sorry, sir. Thank you. And this is out of a mark of respect, obviously, because they've got a white sheet up, John, which I think we safe to assume means that they are bringing out somebody who hasn't survived this. As I say, it is bitterly cold here. At 4:15 in the morning, when this earthquake struck, it was cold, it was raining. It isn't raining now, but the temperatures are frigid, let me tell you. And so there are fires going on all the way around me, behind me. It is an awful, heartbreaking situation. They are understandably asking us to move away at this stage, John.
Becky Anderson, live on the ground for us. Remarkable reporting. Appreciate your showing respect there and walking away as well. It's great to have someone with your experience on the scene. We'll stay in touch, Becky and your crew. Thank you so much. We'll obviously continue to track that dramatic story, the tragedy in Turkey and Syria. Back to Washington now and Joe Biden's big night ahead. In just hours, the president addresses the nation. The Congress serves as his stage to bullet point his achievements, his plans, and his early case for reelection. The setting is the same, but this will feel very, very different tonight. The biggest reason why will be right on the right third of your screen. That would be the House Speaker, now Kevin McCarthy. And his ascendance underlines the new divided reality here in Washington. The speech, we are told by White House officials, will track familiar Biden themes, featuring calls for unity, his bottom-up, middle-out approach to the economy, and a body of evidence to connect the dots, the White House says, between Biden's policies and what they see as remarkable signs of American progress. Let's get straight to the White House. Our chief correspondent, Phil Mattingly, is there. Phil, a big night for the president to look forward, but he wants to look back a little, too.
Yeah, when you talk about that progress, I think there are key components that White House officials point to as underscoring that key progress, whether it comes to the economic side of things, a legislative agenda that really hasn't really been matched over the course of the last 7 or 8 decades in terms of the scale of the accomplishments, and to some degree, a public health crisis that is at least in the waning moments at this point in time, even though the country is still grappling with it. And it's the effort that I think you're going to see from the president tonight to really bring all that together, to capture the moment of not just what's happened in the next 2 years, but what can happen in the next 2 or potentially 6 ahead as he weighs that re-election announcement in the weeks ahead. When you talk about who the president's audience is, I think that's also important. Yes, the in-person audience will be the members of Congress, 535 of them, Republican and Democrat. The real audience is the eyeballs at home for a primetime address. Those millions of Americans that maybe aren't paying attention every single day to what the president has done or the legislative items that he's passed or the agenda that he's now in the midst of implementing. And I think you'll also be able to take a look at what the key elements of this speech are when you look at who will be sitting with the First Lady tonight. You obviously have the parents of Tyre Nichols, who was beaten to death by police just a week or two ago, viscerally watched by Americans on television. You have the Ukrainian ambassador. That will be a central focus of the foreign policy elements of the president's speech. Bono, Paul Pelosi, as the president talks about taking the temperature down from political extremism, and obviously the Monterey Park shooting hero. Mass shootings, which have obviously developed over the course of the last several weeks, as they have for the last several years, will be a key component as well. Overall, though, I think the thematic issues will be familiar to us. We are not necessarily the audience. The audience is the American public, as the president tries to underscore very clear progress, but a job not done yet, a job he wants to finish in the 2 years ahead and perhaps the 6. John?
Perhaps. Always the largest audience the president gets. Phil Mattingly, appreciate your kicking us off from the White House with me in studio to share their reporting and their insights. CNN's MJ Lee, CNN's Melanie Zanona, and Cleve Woodson of The Washington Post. And so, MJ, let's stick. You covered the White House. The president tonight is going to talk about police reform. He's going to urge Congress to pass an assault weapons ban. He's going to say they should reinstate and expand the child tax credit. And he's going to say one way to bring more money into Washington is to raise taxes on billionaires. Zero chance on almost all of those things, if not all of them, in Congress, because it's the Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, over his shoulder. But the president will make the case. The question is, do they have any realistic hopes at the White House of getting anything big done legislatively in the next 2 years?
Well, he will certainly try to make the case that he would like to get all of these things done. And the White House has been talking a lot about sort of this unity agenda, trying to emphasize that even though there is a new political reality in Washington, he still plans to stay laser focused on reaching out to Republicans on some of these issues. But you're absolutely right that the fact that Kevin McCarthy will be sitting behind him the entire time time will serve as a reminder of how difficult it will be to get some of these things done. I also think just Phil really hit it on the nail when he was talking about trying to reach out to the millions of Americans who are tuning in, maybe really for the first time, and sort of absorbing what the president has accomplished and wants to do. I think particularly on the economy, the White House does believe that it has a good story to tell. But you look at the polling and you see that there is a real disconnect, right? When 4 out of 10 Americans are saying that they think their own finances are actually worse now than when the president first took office. Yeah, there's sort of the data side of things. They think the numbers look good, but clearly that is not really translating in terms of the public sentiment.
And so that's the political challenge. How do you try to bring the American people along with you, if you will? You can't lecture them about the economy. People have been through 2+ years of COVID, a couple years of inflation. They're exhausted and they have questions. Jeff Nussbaum, who's a veteran Democratic speechwriter, he's written for President Biden as well, says this in the New York Times. Joe Biden has to say the same thing 1,000 times before the world catches up to him. That's actually meant as a compliment in the sense that Jeff's point is that Joe Biden's not a flashy orator. He's not going to say something that you're going to remember the line like you might have Barack Obama or somebody else. But that he's just consistent and resilient and tough. Biden's often underestimated. The question here is, can he start to break through with the country to say, you can start to feel a little better?
Yeah, this is the biggest megaphone the president has. And the question is it going to be loud enough? MJ talked about that disconnect. There's also a disconnect between what the Biden administration sees as, historic progress that they've made and what Americans see. You have like 62% of Americans saying they've done very little or not enough. And so, will Biden be able to sort of hammer home the fact, just the things that they've done in a way that average Joe on the street is able to understand and sort of take with them through the coming months as these fights continue?
And so one of the big dynamics will be the president's first year. It's not called a State of the Union when you're newly elected, but Nancy Pelosi was behind him and the vice president, Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. Second year, last year, his first State of the Union address, Speaker Pelosi was behind him. Tonight it will be Speaker McCarthy, who says that he wants to do this. He has reverence for the job, he says. Speaker McCarthy saying Nancy Pelosi famously ripped up a Donald Trump speech. He's not going to do that. Listen.
We're members of Congress. We have a code of ethics of how we should portray ourselves, but also do our jobs, and that's exactly what we'll do. But we're not going to be childish games tearing up a speech.
How does he view this moment? And I understand this morning in a meeting he was trying to convince rank-and-file Republicans, some of whom might be more provocative, some of whom might be looking for buzz on social media, that the cameras will be on you, everything you say might be picked up by a microphone, and please behave.
There is a real concerted effort by Kevin McCarthy to position himself as the most reasonable person in the room right now, particularly when it comes to these debt ceiling negotiations. He has tried to strike a calmer tone. I think part of the strategy is to calm the markets. Part of the strategy is also to set up a fall guy in case things go sideways. But when it comes to tonight, it will be interesting to see how these Republicans react if they actually heed McCarthy's advice to behave. We'll see whether that pans out.
It didn't last year.
Right, exactly. But, with the debt ceiling, I'm very interested in what tone President Biden strikes on this, because behind closed doors, it seems he has struck a more conciliatory tone with these talks that are very early on with Kevin McCarthy. But how hard does he go? Does he continue to insist no conditions on hiking the debt ceiling? Does he chastise Republicans as MAGA Republicans? Does that poison the well? I mean, there's going to be a lot of pie in the sky talk tonight, a lot of pop and circumstance, but the debt ceiling is the most important thing that they have to
do. And so how does the White House view that in the sense that, during the campaign, the president talked about extreme MAGA Republicans. In several events recently, he said that what do they mean by spending cuts? When they say let's reduce spending, what do they mean? Do they mean Social Security and Medicare? How specific, I guess, how pointed will he be tonight, or will it be more of a let's try to be bipartisan and then see if it collapses?
Well, typically when you are listening to President Biden making a speech when he's out on the road, it is very common for him to use language like MAGA Republicans, like extremism, and really trying to paint House Republicans in particular as being too extreme, as getting in the way, objecting to really any kind of progress that Washington might be able to make. This is a very different setting, right? The number of times, again, that White House officials have been using language like the unity agenda, you know, it might feel a little bit less appropriate for the president in front of every member of Congress to use that kind of language. But at the same time, it is really important for him politically as a political messaging tool to contrast Democrats and himself from those very House Republicans that he often does criticize. So it will be sort of a balancing act, I think, for this president.
And you mentioned the frustration at the White House that the American people don't feel they've accomplished much, that they get the frustration with the economy. People just don't feel it personally yet, even if the numbers might support otherwise. Part of the president's challenge tonight is to convince Americans that, you know, he's up to the job, which sounds bizarre. But if he's planning to run for re-election and he's 80 years old, the idea being that, you know, I'm up for this and I want it.
Yeah, you have these built-in concerns, not just from Americans in general, but also from Democrats about whether Biden is too old, about how he'll fare against a potentially younger opponent. And so a lot of this is about him showing not just, you know, these are the things that I can do, but like this is, you know, I am the person that can kind of drive it over the finish line the next couple of years.
Always one of the biggest days in Washington. Can't wait for tonight. Up next for us, Congress getting briefed today on the China balloon drama. It will also be a topic in the president's State of the Union speech. This morning at the Capitol, staff members for the top lawmakers, the so-called Gang of Eight, briefed behind closed doors on the Chinese balloon. The White House confirms the president will mention the balloon tonight in the foreign policy section of his State of the Union speech. Our great reporters are back at the table. MJ, let me start with you because you cover the White House. This is Kate Bedingfield, the president's communications director this morning, saying, of course, the balloon drama will be in the speech, but she suggests not that much had to be rewritten.
The president has obviously worked to continue to manage our relationship with China to a place of competition and not conflict. I would anticipate that he will mention the events of the last week. But again, the speech and the larger pieces about his foreign policy have not been reworked. We ultimately shot it down and sent a very direct message to China that it was unacceptable.
I expect the president to track that. It was unacceptable.
Right.
But you do have, you know, the American people captivated by this now on an issue that maybe sometimes it's hard to break through and get their attention about the economic, the strategic challenge that is China. What will we hear from the president?
I mean, it's not at all surprising that China would be a part of the foreign policy element of this address tonight. I think the devil's really in the details and really the tone, right? What we have seen with this incident is the threat of sort of undercutting what the president has been working on when it comes to China. I mean, for one, it has been very important for this president to sort of show that the U.S. can contain China, can compete with China. And now we have Republicans saying that he has been weak on China over this incident, right? And then secondly, obviously, over the last couple of months, there has been a real effort to try to reset things with Beijing. That is now in the rearview mirror. We don't know. I mean, officials are pretty blunt in saying this has not been good for U.S.-Chinese relations, to point out the obvious. I'm just watching out to see exactly what his tone is. Does he say, yes, this was not an acceptable breach? However, we sort of got more out of it than you might have expected. Or does he sort of send a stronger message to Beijing and sort of say, like, yeah, lay off. Xi Jinping, I see you, and you can't do this anymore.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the reaction from Republicans. As MJ notes, a lot of Republicans early on said the president should have shot it down, you know, second it crossed into U.S. airspace. He's a sign of weakness. We were expecting some resolution, but now Republicans are sort of waiting to do that. This is Byron Donalds. He says, we want to make sure that we have all our ducks in a row, and we get to play politics, so many things in here, but this is a very serious issue. Is this an issue on which the partisanship, actually the initial reflex partisanship, has now taken a back seat because there is this new bipartisan commission and they are trying to actually prove Democrats and Republicans can have an adult conversation about China? Has that pulled back from a partisan resolution?
That is the hope anyway. So I think with Republicans, the natural instinct, as we saw over the weekend, is to devolve into partisan bomb throwing. But with China, it's a really delicate issue. There's a desire to put on a united front. I think Republicans and Democrats alike recognize that there is a benefit to putting on that united front against a foreign adversary. That is why the resolution that Republicans were initially considering, it was going to criticize Biden. Now it's going to criticize China more broadly over the spy balloon. There's also this select committee that they put together, and they are trying to show a united front. The chairman and the ranking member, a Democrat and a Republican, put out a joint statement. They are saying that they are hopeful that they can embody that type of bipartisan relationship, but it's going to be tough. I mean, there's concerns about Republicans using this as a platform to bash Biden. There's concerns about this fueling anti-Asian rhetoric. But the chairman is very cognizant of those concerns. He purposely changed the name of the committee to say Chinese Communist Party instead of China to draw that distinction. But we'll see. I mean, it's going to be a tough road ahead for them.
And the foreign policy section of the State of the Union is often sort of the afterthought, right? A president's, especially the last few years, you're in the COVID pandemic, you're dealing with inflation, uncertain economic signals. Here, with the China challenge and the president trying to keep the American people invested in what's happening in Ukraine, this is critical.
Yeah, and you have to also remember that foreign policy is part of Biden's brand. When he was running for president, he said, you know, all these other guys can do domestic stuff, everybody can do that, but I know foreign policy. I know these people on a first-name basis. And so to project strength or to project weakness is particularly damaging for, you know, for Biden going forward. But I also think about what the Secretary of State said earlier this week or maybe last week. You still got to go back to the table with China or whatever. So I'm interested in his tone and whether it's too sharp or whether it kind of takes him to a place where you can't go back to the negotiating table with China.
You're so right that such a big part of his messaging was bringing America back to the world stage in a more acceptable and respectable way after Donald Trump. So I do think that will be a really key theme and a tone that we hear from the president tonight, regardless.
All right, another reason to watch. Up next, Kevin McCarthy confirms the House Ethics Committee is now investigating the freshman Republican George Santos, what the embattled New York congressman is saying about that. We now know officially that George Santos is under investigation by the House Ethics Committee. The House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, confirming that to CNN for the first time earlier today. But the freshman Republican says he is not concerned that, even as he faces mounting problems on multiple fronts. And get this, a busload of his constituents right now is on the way to Washington to call on Mr. Santos to be expelled from Congress.
Who is representing us? I feel like this is some kind of storybook character that's scamming us and laughing because we're being scammed.
It's amazing that somebody can just lie as much as he did without any compassion of who he's insulted.
Our great reporters are back with us. He is a storybook character, Mel, and the speaker today confirming for the first time the House Ethics Committee is taking a look. We know that the FEC and regulatory agencies are looking at his campaign. We know the Justice Department has an investigation of some of his cat. But George Santos says, first day of the union tonight, all's good.
Yeah, so George Santos, we know he's under investigation now by the House Ethics Committee. He's facing these litany of investigations. He has been really trying to push back in a way that we haven't seen before, and he's been really defiant in face of these calls to resign. But for Kevin McCarthy, the strategy here is to just keep distance. They can really hide behind the fact that there is an investigation on the House Ethics Committee at the federal, local, state levels. And they can say, let's just let those play out before we have to make a decision. But there will be a time when the House Ethics Committee makes some sort of a determination. There could be an indictment that comes down. And then House GOP leadership will have to make a decision about how they're going to handle this member. If they do push him out of Congress, there's going to be a special election. They could lose that seat. But for now, they're just hoping that this all goes away.
And one of the questions or several of the questions revolve around campaign finance. There's a great CNN story today by our team. Santos' unusual $199.99 campaign expenses are putting scrutiny on his longtime treasurer. The reporting shows that this treasurer also at one point worked for Lee Zeldin, former congressman who ran for governor of New York. And the same thing, you have to detail anything above $200. So if it's $199.99, raises some skepticism there. But listen to George Santos. He says, well, I'm the congressman. That's my campaign.
I'm not a campaign treasurer. I couldn't answer that for you.
So you're unaware those were listed?
Like I said, I don't do my own treasury. Never did.
Forgive me, but that's a cop-out. I don't do my own treasury. Never did. The candidate is the CEO of the campaign. Like it or not, you got to pay attention.
Yeah, sure. And there seems to be no question that this kind of conveyor belt of accusations and stuff is going to keep coming. The question is whether we know how it impacts Santos. The question is whether it will continue to erode trust in other Republicans and McCarthy. I think McCarthy's statement is if ethics finds something, you know, we'll take action. But like, do the American people really have confidence that with these paper thin majorities in the House that they actually will take action and expel him?
Yeah, what does it do to the Republican brand if they continue to defend the guy and say he gets to be on committees, he gets to do all these things? He's asked voluntarily to step down from committees because the speaker finally realized it was becoming an embarrassment. But I've been doing this a long time. Do you ever remember a freshman member of Congress who has consumed so much oxygen?
no. And we are just in this incredible, remarkable news cycle where every day there does seem to be some new story, some new lie, some new fabrication, some peculiar, you know, narrative from his past. But I do think what's remarkable, Mel, you should correct me if I'm wrong, but it does seem like even, you know, compared to a couple of weeks ago when we didn't know all of the information we know now, I mean, he's kind of in the same place, right, when it comes to the big question of whether he is close to being expelled from Congress. Like, we are waiting for the House Ethics Committee to now do this investigation. As you said, McCarthy is basically deferring to that committee. But at this moment in time, even under the, you know, the pressure that he is facing, even given all of that, he's not really close to being expelled from Congress.
No, I do think it's interesting, though, that some of these other House Republicans from New York in his freshman class have gone out of their way to call for him to resign. I mean, to your point, Cleve, this is them recognizing that this could be a huge problem for them. Whatever happens to Santos, right, this could fall back on them. And so they're trying to create that distance.
Even McCarthy seems to be inching there. He needs the vote, but even he seems to slowly be coming to the realization this dance is not going to last all that long. When we come back, President Biden and you, the president's approval ratings heading into his big night, the State of the Union address. We'll take you inside the numbers in just a minute. Big night for the president tonight, the annual State of the Union address. Part of the president's challenge is to try to convince you politely that maybe he's doing a better job than you think. By that, I mean this. If you look at the president's approval rating right now, it is at 41%. Yes, that's up a little bit from 38%. That's where he was last year for a State of the Union address. But the president, ramping up for a re-election run, would like to boost his approval rating some. So let's walk back through the arc of the Biden presidency. His first year, it's not technically a State of the Union address, but a big speech to Congress from the newly elected president. Unemployment rate, 5.3%. Inflation was starting to become an issue in the American economy, and we were in a horrible COVID winter, more than 142,000 peak. That was the hospitalizations there. So let's move forward to 2022. The unemployment rate coming down. The president will talk about that. He wants to convince you the economy is doing better than you think. But inflation still nagging, 6.5% last year. And again, a horrific COVID winter. Hospitalizations up above 160,000 at the peak. So where are we now as the president comes in to his third year in office? The unemployment rate, a 50-year low. You'll hear about that tonight. We'll see, but inflation does seem to be easing some. We'll see where that number ends up at the end of the year. And yes, COVID is still with us, but the strain on the American hospital system and healthcare system much more mild than it was the past two winters. So as the president looks forward, he wants to look back. You're going to hear a lot about all this tonight. The American Rescue Plan, the infrastructure plan, violence against women, gun safety, science and chips, judicial appointments to the bench. The president will talk about his record looking backwards. He'll also highlight several of these were bipartisan pieces of legislation. Part of the new dynamic tonight with a Republican House, the president's going to say the odds are high against this. We can get some things done. And so here's the big difference. When the president spoke a year ago, because Democrats had the majority, it was Nancy Pelosi behind him as speaker. Tonight, Republicans have the majority for the first time in the Biden presidency. It will be Kevin McCarthy behind the president of the United States. So let's start our conversation with this dynamic. Joining us now is the Republican pollster, Kristen Salter Sanderson. And Kristen, how does the president deal with this new reality in Washington? And how do the Republicans deal with him?
Well, in his ninth speech, he's going to be looking back, but he's also got to be thinking forward. He's going to be thinking about the fact that you've got things like the debt limit that are going to be coming up. There's still 2 years left in his presidency. Presumably, he'd like to do something with them. But Republicans don't feel like they have a ton of incentive to have to do a lot of working with him. Even though the midterms were underwhelming for Republicans, the GOP base is not in love with Joe Biden. They've got a primary of their own that's going to be happening on the Republican side. So what Joe Biden, I think, needs to do with tonight's speech is make the case to Republicans, look, you're going to want some sort of responsible spending things in order to happen, in order to raise the debt limit. Here's what I'm willing to do, and begin to try to ratchet up that pressure on Republicans, or else you're going to see some big gridlock as we head toward the summer.
If you're a Democrat or a Republican, any president, any prominent politician has a healthy ego and a lot of confidence. That's part of being successful in politics. So this ticks you off. The approval rating on the economy, only 37% approve of the president's job performance. Does he have the leadership? 68% there lack confidence in his leadership. 62% think he's accomplished little in his time in office. How do you convince people, please change your mind, but be polite about it? You can't tell people you're wrong.
That's right. You can't tell somebody, hey, you feel like the economy's not good, but I'm telling you, I promise, don't believe the price of the eggs at the grocery store, whatever it is that's making people feel very frustrated. It's tough whenever you are a politician who believes you're not getting enough credit for things and you want to go persuade the American people that you deserve more. I think the challenge he's going to have is you don't want to walk in and be Pollyanna-ish. Everything's fine, everything's wonderful, and I did it. Because in some ways, Americans are saying, I don't think things are so good, and I really think if they're better, I'm not interested in giving you credit. You can take something like COVID, for instance. I have no doubt that the president's going to want to say, look, we got through the worst of this pandemic, and he's going to want to say, we've defeated it. And frankly, underline, I've defeated it as president. But for many Americans, they're going to go, great, I'm not giving you credit for that. That's table stakes. That's the minimum that I was expecting. I'm expecting an economy that kind of works okay, the ability to afford my groceries. I don't want to give you a ton of bonus points for giving me what I think ought to be a basic just way of life functioning in America.
Well, I know you're a Republican, but if you're advising the president, how do you handle this question? Even some of his friends, allies, watching him gear up for re-election say, are you sure, sir? Are you sure because of your age? This is Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times today. Biden's a great president. He should not run again. She believes he's just too old for the job. David Axelrod, who worked with him in the Obama White House when he was vice president. If I were still a practicing political strategist and had the president's record, I think you could easily reelect him. But the question has never been political. It's actuarial. This isn't about his performance. It's really about age. How important is the speech tonight when you have the largest audience a president gets in any year to convince the American people, I'm good at my job, and I can do it for six more years?
Well, the first line of folks that he needs to convince are folks within his own party. And of course, if he is the incumbent president, decides he wants to run again, I don't imagine he'd face a strong primary challenger barring something extraordinary happening. But right now, when I go out and do focus groups of voters, swing voters, and I mention to them, well, what would you think if you had a rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden? I mean, just the physical reaction to that. And so he's got to put at ease folks that are thinking, oh, I don't know if I really want to watch another rerun of this all over again.
New faces. Elections are often about that. Kirsten, appreciate your coming. We'll watch the president tonight. And you should be sure to join us, please. Watch CNN's live coverage. President Biden's State of the Union address starts tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, right here. We'll be right back. I want to bring you some important news just into CNN. Sources telling us the Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh, will soon leave the Biden administration. Walsh, remarkably, would be the first cabinet secretary to exit during President Biden's tenure. Let's get straight to the White House. CNN's Phil Mattingly is there. Phil, tell us more.
What we are understanding right now, according to sources familiar with the matter, is the Labor Secretary Marty Walsh will soon depart in order to take a job as the executive director of the NHL Players Association. Longtime Bruins fan is the current Labor Secretary. Sounds like a pretty good gig that he has lined up. Now, it's not official yet, and obviously he will be in the audience for the President's State of the Union. But I think what this underscores right now is, as you and I both know, John, this is a typical traditional moment of transition for any administration after the second year. We've seen some internal transition. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain will be leaving tomorrow. National Economic Council Director Brian Deese will be leaving shortly as well. But we have seen remarkable stability across the cabinet level. Marty Walsh had not been expected to leave, at least in the near term, until this opportunity came up. Now that appears likely to happen. Other critical cabinet members at this point in time, we don't know of anybody who's leaving imminently. But when it comes to Marty Walsh, I think the importance here is just how significant a role he's played inside the administration. If you think of about some of the major kind of pop-up economic crises this administration faced, whether it was on supply chains, whether it was on rail strikes, or the potential for rail strikes, Marty Walsh was always in the center of those, was always President Biden's kind of delegated representative to deal with labor, to deal with business, and try and find some common and middle ground here, and often, if not always, successfully did, close to the president, obviously, as labor often is. And I would note, it's good to see somebody from Dorchester moving on to good things, John. You may know something about that, hockey, the Bruins, Dorchester, but this is a good example of Dorchester boy doing well.
I was waiting for that one. I was waiting for that one. Son of Ohio, Phil Mattingly at the White House. Phil, thanks for that. Look, it is a good story. I'm a Dorchester kid. Marty Walsh is a compelling personal story. Union laborer, battled alcoholism, went on to be mayor of Boston. Now he's a member of the Biden cabinet. As Phil notes, he said, as a guy not from Washington, he's been in the middle, the thick of some big issues here. Number one, what does the president lose here? The president himself always says he's brother of the labor. He loses a guy here who actually was a union worker.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. There was a moment earlier in the administration when we actually expected there to be a flood of departures. We never saw that coming. And that never actually happened. And now I think we are at a moment of transition where after the State of the Union, we will get more announcements like this. I think there are two factors for why we haven't seen this moment come yet. One is just that the administration and the White House has really been on a winning streak. You know, you want to be on the winning team. And with the economy rebounding, obviously the good results for Democrats in the midterms, there were a number of people that I think sort of decided to stick around because it feels good when the administration is on a good track. I think the other thing is just the Biden factor, right? It's not been totally clear over the last several months whether for sure the president was going to run for re-election in a second term. Now we know that we are expecting him to announce for another 4 years in the coming weeks. And I think certain people in the administration have sort of been waiting for clarity on that moment. And now we have that.
And we should also point out in terms of confirming his replacement, now Democrats added a seat in the Senate, so it'll be easier to move nominations and confirm nominations. I don't know if that was a factor in the decision-making, but it certainly will be something that we are watching.
And you mentioned the lack of the very limited turnover, especially at the cabinet level, this being the first one. There was some talk that because of disagreements over policy between the White House and the Department of Homeland Security, that Secretary Mayorkas would be maybe one of the early ones to go. And then the Republicans threatened to impeach him, which immediately gets everybody in their partisan corner, and his job security is better now because the Biden administration is fine. Let's have that fight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the question or what this kind of sets up after the State of the Union is, you know, what does Biden have for this fight with Republicans going forward with a Republican led House and all that stuff? He has a lot of people around him, a lot of trusted advisors. You know, Klain's gone, Deese is gone, Marty Walsh is gone. But there's a lot of stability there that allows him to make a better argument to the American people tonight and over the next 2 years.
Right. That is a great story. As a kid from Dorchester, Marty Walsh, as we say back home. He's from the wrong parish, but he's doing all right. Let's, before we go quickly, Sarah Huckabee Sanders will deliver the Republican response tonight. She's a former Trump White House press secretary, so people around the country know who she is. She's been governor for less than a month. Why? Why did the Republicans decide she is the person we want to put forward at this important moment?
Well, you know, she's young. She's a woman. But I think another factor is that she's not a threat to Trump in terms of potentially running against him. If they would have picked someone like DeSantis or Tim Scott or someone, it could have been perceived as them trying to position someone else to take Trump on. So I would suspect that is a factor. But she is someone who Republicans love. She was in the Trump White House. She gave it to the press. They loved that. She's been in the governor's mansion for a little bit, attacking some of these, you know, red meat issues. And so I think that Republicans, you know, are excited to hear from her tonight. It's a big opportunity for her.
It's always a tough job, to deliver the response. Her dad was the governor. It is the first father-daughter team to be governor. Why? Why Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
Well, I think, like Melanie said, you know, she does have the Trump imprimatur. She does not pose a threat, really, to any Republicans out there. But also, you know, she's used to speaking to the country, right? She's used to making that sort of cogent Republican argument to the country, and that has to be an advantage when you're going up against Biden.
And she has, to your point, she has leaned in very aggressively right out of the box, banning Latinx from any state documents, saying critical race theory will not be taught in the Arkansas public schools. She says, like many governors and attorneys generals, Republicans, saying we're going to look to ban drag shows.
Yeah, and certainly these kinds of sort of culture war issues are issues that people with 2024 aspirations have really embraced. And I don't think that is surprising. Republican elected officials or people with political aspirations have very much seen that these sort of lightning rod issues have been an effective tool to some extent in sort of rallying their supporters. But I do think there are plenty of Democrats who would say, no, it's not always a winning message. Like some certain specific issues, maybe, but also not necessarily in a general election either.
Right. That's the key point. Plays well with a slice of the Republican primary electorate. We'll see. I'm guessing tonight's going to be much more about economics and tone out in the country. Again, President's State of the Union address tonight. Hope you will join us. Thanks for your time today on Inside Politics. Abby Phillip picks up our coverage after a quick break. Have a good afternoon.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.